Well, good afternoon. I guess we're having a meeting here with the Planning Commission. Is this an official protocol, even though we're in here? Is that, they're supposed to be doing this?
Yep.
Okay, all right. So with that, I guess we'll go with introductions.
Jim Swenson, South Kitsap.
Aaron Murphy, North Kitsap.
Joe Phillips, Central.
Gina Busker, Central Kitsap.
Spencer Stegman, North Kitsap.
Tom Nevins, North Kitsap.
Richard Shattuck, Central.
And I'm Robert Baglio, South Kitsap. Let's see, as far as our agenda, are we okay with the agenda as presented? Is there a second? We go to second.
Are you being added to the agenda?
I thought I had been added to the agenda.
So there's one edit. Eric is doing findings of fact.
Okay. And we are we letting him go first so he can come and go? Would that be preferred?
No.
Okay. All right.
He looks fairly.
So I guess we'll do that after the approval of the minutes. How's that sound? So we'll call it Mickey D and we'll adjust everything else down. Are you okay with that?
Yes. We'll approve as amended.
Any discussion? No. All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, so we're on to the approval of the minutes. Everyone got a chance to take a look at them? Is there a motion for approval?
The move to approve.
Any discussion?
I appreciate the time and the release of those minutes.
Yes. I guess just looking at these. Oh, okay. All right, with that, any further discussion on the minutes? If none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Next, we have Mr. Baker with the finding of the facts.
Thank you very much. Based upon the public hearing and deliberation.
Thank you very much.
Based upon the testimony and findings of facts in your last Planning Commission meeting associated with the transitory accommodation, boarding houses, and fitness center regulations, what you see before you are draft findings of fact and then the places in the code in which the Planning Commission recommended changes. The three changes, well, the two changes that the Planning Commission requested involved three changes to the draft, the first of which was the removal of a single-family transitory accommodation as a concept, so it had to be removed in two places, one in the area where it had its substantive code elements, but also one other place where it referenced the process. Those are all highlighted in yellow in the document that you see. And then number two was the requirement for a neighborhood meeting consistent with Title 21 prior to the finalizing of any transitory accommodation as permanent. As it shows in the rest of the code, that part to make transitory accommodation permanent, you need to go through an administrative conditional use permit. That doesn't necessarily include a community meeting or a public hearing. The Planning Commission was very interested in there being some kind of a loop back to the neighborhood to basically see how the temporary use was going and making sure that the conditions are appropriate. The findings of fact that you see before you are largely procedural, but it does come down to your recommendations, which are on the second page. The recommendations are, again, for the changes that will be include what you see before you. I didn't kill quite as many trees as was necessary, but what we're hoping for is review and approval and signature by the chair of the Planning Commission. These will then be forwarded to the Board of County Commissioners, as well as your minutes and tape of the events for their review as they hold a public hearing on March 13th.
Okay. Any questions for Eric? Without that, I guess, is there a motion for the approval of the finding of facts?
So moved.
Second that.
Okay. I guess any discussion? I know that probably the folks that have the motion regarding the...
Correct. I'm just now.
Okay.
I apologize, Commissioner Gonzalez. You don't have a copy of the yellow sheet, so my liberal arts degree didn't allow me to count properly.
Okay, so I guess any discussion?
It's just that this page will be attached to the findings of fact.
Yes, it'll be attached to the findings of fact, and will accompany. It'll be an attachment A. Looks like this includes all the other changes that you did approve. Those are the three pages in which the Planning Commission made changes. Everything else remains the same from the document that I handed out at the last Planning Commission meeting.
Okay. Discussion. Vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstained.
Unless you're doing business with these fine folks.
Okay, so I understand Shelley is ill?
Yes, she is unable to provide payments today. So okay. We'll arrange one at a time.
All right. So actually, that's another modification to the agenda, but overall. And so now we're going on to Ann. Yeah, how do you say that? Yeah, if you want to, hopefully the light's not shining right to Eric's room. It's barely in a bright light. Are you going to be certified after this?
Certifiable. Yeah. And you probably, we won't be as quick as your previous person. My name is Ann Fritzel. I work for the Department of Commerce in Growth Management Services. I've been there since about 2000, working with communities on their comprehensive planning, and for the last 3 years being the coordinator of the short course statewide. So normally this is a three-hour event. Get a couple of three speakers in. It's a big to-do. We're going to try to get it done very quickly, but there will be homework. I'd like to introduce Gary Eilberg. He's my my colleague at Department of Commerce, and he is assigned to assist Kitsap County. So as we take the short course, we always have the local person. I don't get to go to everyone, but it's always a fun event. So you have a bunch of paper in your possession. I'm going to start with this is the booklet. If you read this, and it should take you about 10 minutes, you will know what you do not know. And you will know the things that you need to go and find out more information about. This is the quick version. There is a longer version of this book. It's about 300 pages that you should read after you've read this. So the next thing I want to go to is this page right here. This is the standard agenda for the short course on local planning. And instead of including a lot of speakers, I've included our videos. We now have a video series on the web so that anybody who needs and who becomes a planning commissioner and all of a sudden needs to know everything in a hurry, they can binge watch on YouTube until they fully get the gist of the breadth things that you should know as a planning commissioner. So how long have you been on the planning commission?
2 weeks.
10 years.
About a month.
6 months.
And I think maybe combined 6 years perhaps.
Pretty good.
Two years?
About four.
That must mean six. I don't know. I can't remember. Okay, so it's like I've never left. So a pretty good mix. So as you can see on the basic agenda,
There are four main topics. And at the bottom, these are the sponsors of the short course. So we have the two planning associations in Washington that give us money to coordinate the course because they see that this course has value in helping staff do better jobs in planning, helping you understand the different roles. And the other people that we have, our supporters, are the Washington Cities Insurance Authority and AWC. Those are the insurance pools for cities and counties. And land use holds a lot of risk. So they provide funding to Commerce to coordinate this course to avoid that risk. Because there's a number of things that you should know about. And we're here to provide some of that information. So it's unfortunate that Shelley's not here. She just didn't have a voice to be able to do this. She'll come back, but if there are questions that you have now, if I can't answer them, we'll write them down and make sure that they get covered next time. So these are the series of videos. You don't even need Gary and I, but it's always better to have the first in-person video. So hear it once. Watch your videos, read this booklet. At the bottom of this page, it says read the manual, and that's the long version. And by that time, you've heard it three times, and you should be good to go. This is our certificate of training. Now, if you are appointed to an advisory body like a planning commission, you're required to have the Open Public Meetings Act training within 90 days of being appointed. So you can go online and watch our video. And once you've completed that, you can sign this certificate. So we won't be providing the detail on the Open Public Meetings Act today. We can go over it briefly. And then you hand it into your staff so that they'll have a record that you completed your training. Does anybody have the Open Public Meetings?
Last year, we had one for those.
So this is something we worked with the Attorney General for the state to make sure that our training meet their requirements. On the back is more information about our partners and more training opportunities. Do you know about Municipal Research, MRSC? That's something valuable and unique that we have in Washington. It's publicly funded. Any city and county can use their resources. They have all kinds of example codes. If you say, I'm calling behalf of city and county, they will answer your questions. They are an amazing resource that we have in Washington that's of great value to cities and counties. If you are an elected official or a legal person, you can get free credits on the back from attending the short course. The other piece, the last piece of paper I gave you was practice tips. This is produced by MRSC. And these are the tips on Open Public Meetings Act and Public Records Act that provide you the very detailed information that you should know.
So the manual, the full manual, I assume if you go on the Department of Commerce website, is that available on the website as well? Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, we used to come to the short course and we'd hand you all the big fat manual and say go get a binder and read the manual, but it's just too much money and too much paper to lug around. So it's available online. And here's our webpage, and at the end of my presentation I'll go through again and make sure you know how to get there.
Are you able to distribute this as an active PDF so that we can click through that?
Yeah, I could do that.
I touch it, it doesn't come up on the screen, but that would be cool.
Yeah, I'll do that, and I'll show you where to go on our website, too.
Okay.
So let's get started. Now that I've introduced the short course, the first piece would be the legal framework on land use planning, which Shelley would cover. It describes the basic. Planning really started way back when they said zoning is constitutional, it's okay to do. You can zone, you have the right to determine where uses are. And then through the Subdivision Act, as a city or county approved a subdivision, they had to make sure that there were adequate provisions for water, sewer, parks, places to walk to schools. And then gradually, we got to the 70s where we're concerned about the environmental impacts, so we introduced SEPA, the State Environmental Policy Act, which looked at the individual actions from an environmental basis. And then we introduced the Shoreline Management Act, which says we're concerned about how shorelines work. And then in 1990, we got to the Growth Management Act because we were concerned about the impacts of growth. So Gary is going to cover that piece for us. You want to come up here and do that? Oh, that is mine. Can you get the other one up? The other presentation? Oh, right here. Oh, okay.
Yes, that's it.
Is that working? Yeah, totally working. Yes, okay. There you go.
Okay. Good evening. As Ann said, I'm Gary Eidelberg. I've been with the Department of Commerce since last June. And before that, I worked for about 15 years for Snohomish County, so I'm really familiar with kind of how planning commissions functions and the like. And we took advantage of this at Snohomish County, and so it's really a helpful thing for planning commissions, as well as other, as well as county staff and others, to kind of get a handle, an understanding of kind of what the Growth Management Act is, what it's all about, and kind of your relationship to it and things that you're doing and things that staff are doing. And so with that, I'll move through this. And please feel free to stop and ask me questions. And I have some interesting anecdotes, too. Why is planning important? One of my early supervisors at Ecology always said, failing to plan, planning to fail. So it is true. But why planning is important is laid out in these bullets here. You want to be able to kind of know where your community wants to go, why they want to go there. I mean, in terms of a direction of what it wants to look like and how it is going to identify itself, and as well as kind of respond to the needs of your community and your constituents.
Oops, something
there.
Oh, the difference is click. public expectations. One of the things about public expectations, especially with developers, is they want consistency. It's a lot of people, if you keep changing the rules or if they don't know how long it's going to take to get something done or not get something done, it becomes very frustrating. As well as, this quote, this affects my neighborhood, my home, I should have a say in what happens. It's like you're building X in one place and how come I wasn't notified? Or, why don't I understand what's going on here and why it's going on? The importance of planning has changed over the last few decades. These are some of the reasons that planning was important in kind of the 1950s. Growth accommodation was not as big of a thing then as it is now. Environmental review, one project at a time, so people weren't really looking at kind of a conglomerate impact necessarily, but kind of how things were going to be going on in the immediate sense. About the year 2000, the interest in planning, took on some of these interests. We were concerned about loss of habitat, traffic congestion has become really difficult over the last 50 years and has become more difficult in the last decade or so. And one of the things that have really annoyed developers is an unpredictable development process. I don't know when I can expect to get a permit. I don't know when I can expect to do whatever I need to do, and you are costing money and other complaints related to that. This, is a profile of kind of population, of actual population and projected population, out to 2040. And as you can gather, pretty much every jurisdiction and county and city in Washington State is growing to a certain degree. And it's probably not going to stop anytime soon because Washington State is a nice place to live. You know, lots of people want to come here. I grew up in Kansas. I went to grad school in Boston, and my buddy in Bellingham said, "Gary, come on out to Washington State. Come to Seattle, man. You'll love it." So here we are. And Kitsap County, this is a projection for growth in Kitsap County. As you can see in the lowest section, there is projected growth out to 2040. So in varying degrees, you know, growth is happening. And unless, you know, we become kind of like China, where you can tell people where to live and where not to live, it's probably going to continue for the foreseeable future. Why the Growth Management Act? There was a big concern in the early 1990s that this was not going to be a nice place to live because of uncontrolled growth and unpredictable growth and difficulty in understanding how to and difficulty in understanding how to deal with new populations coming in and servicing things that people needed. These are some of the these bullets kind of surmise why the Growth Management Act was put together in the first place. Since I moved out here, politically, there's always been a lot of push and pull between people who really did not want any kind of growth and people who wanted to kind of make this area sort of a small LA. So you've had this over the last few decades that I've noticed, there's been a dialectical tension between those two types of groups. But I think pretty much everyone understands that uncontrolled growth and sprawl in the end is more expensive and in the end causes an undesirable living space. The Growth Management Act has 14 goals, and these goals are not necessarily in any priority or order, but they're not prioritized in the law. Some goals require more emphasis in some jurisdictions than others, and these goals guide preparation of comprehensive plans. And one thing we don't have an attorney here, but I've been in jurisdictions where if a certain jurisdiction is not pursuing a goal, you can be challenged over someone thinking that a goal should be pursued and your jurisdiction is not doing that. Urban growth is designed to encourage development in urban areas where adequate public facilities and services exist, can be provided in an efficient manner. Number two, reducing sprawl is fairly obvious. Reduction of inappropriate conversion of undeveloped land into sprawling low-density development is, at first people might think it's attractive, but in the end it's very expensive, and in the end it's very unattractive. Transportation, encourage efficient multimodal transportation systems that are based on regional priorities and coordinated with county and city comprehensive plans. Transportation will make or break many communities. Inefficient transportation can cause businesses and people to not move to certain places because it could might be too hard to get around, too hard to move goods and services around. Housing. Encourage the availability of affordable housing to all economic segments of the population of the state. Promote a variety of residential densities and housing types, and encourage preservation of existing housing stock. And see, do we have these more?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Economic development. Encourage economic development throughout the state that is consistent with adopted comprehensive plans, promote economic opportunity for all systems of the state, especially for unemployed and for disadvantaged persons, promote the retention and expansion of existing businesses and recruitment of new businesses, recognize regional differences impacting economic development opportunities, and encourage growth in areas experiencing insufficient economic growth, all within the capacities of the state's natural resources, public services, and public facilities. And in a more modern sense, this should really be coupled with environmental concerns, because once you tip too far one way or too far the other, you begin to have quite a bit of problems. Property rights. Property shall not be taken for public use without just compensation having been made. The property rights of landowners shall be protected from arbitrary and discriminatory action. That's fairly self-explanatory. Maintain natural resource industries. Maintain and enhance natural resource-based industries, including productive timber, agriculture, and fisheries industries. Encourage the conservation of productive forest lands and productive agricultural lands, and discourage incompatible uses. Protect the environment is self-explanatory. And as I said, one of the reasons you want to protect the environment is because, in my opinion, you want to continue economic development. If you don't protect the environment, economic development becomes more difficult. Encourage citizen participation. That's part of why you're here. Citizen participation is really important, especially related to the Growth Management Act, where people are going to have direct access to understanding the decisions of why they're made and having a voice in it is through you all. And that is a direct link to encourage citizen participation. You place ads and so forth, talking about your meetings and so forth. Ensure availability of public facilities and services. At my old job, this is one we got sued over, and because difficulties with capital facilities and transportation. Quite a bit with transportation, because people were very dissatisfied with delay times and related air pollution and things that are related to not having adequate public facilities. And so we'll come back to this later and looking at parts of the components of comprehensive plans. Encourage historic preservation. This can be more important in some areas than others, but historic preservation is really important in places where you've had a long history, either Native American history or things that are related to early settlement and other things that people are interested in preserving. And as Ann alluded to, managing shoreline development has been recently added, because, and obviously you wouldn't have something like shoreline development necessarily too much in Kansas or Missouri or other places, but here it is an important, shoreline is it's an important resource, an environmental resource, and managing development is part of environmental preservation and keeping shorelines the way that the people really kind of expect shorelines to be. The land speaks first. The slide talks about counties need to designate and conserve natural resources. Agriculture and forest lands are designated and conserved to protect these industries and our economies, because a lot of times, in a lot of places, agricultural lands are disappearing to a certain extent, and the connection between small farms and big farms is becoming greater. So you really want to preserve agriculture and forest lands in order to protect these industries and the related economy. Environmentally critical areas were also designated and protected to protect against risk to human life and to protect the important functions and values that are provided by wetlands, aquifer recharge areas, and fish and wildlife habitat areas. And this is also to protect kind of intrinsic investment that those things represent. Fully or partially planting. As you can see by the deep blue, the counties that are shaded in deep blue are the ones that are fully planting, and obviously Kitsap County is in there. You're fully planting for under the Growth Management Act. And many counties, such as those in the central Puget Sound, were growing quickly and were required to plant under the GMA. Some counties, as Ferry County, Stevens, and Pend'Oreille counties, fully planned, and they chose to. They wanted to plant under the GMA when it was first adopted. And Douglas, Kittitas, Pacific, Benton, Franklin, Walla Walla, Columbia, and Garfield counties also opted in. As of 2014, the legislation passed Bill Number 1224, would allow Ferry, Stevens, and Pend'Oreille County to revert to partially planning status. Other counties that have to plan for critical areas and resource lands develop full comprehensive plans using the GMA framework because it is useful for making local decisions. Countywide planning policies. When you're planning under the Growth Management Act, countywide planning policies are really helpful, and it's really important that they're kind of a good bridge to coordinate policies between cities and counties and small jurisdictions. These policies help to ensure that plans within a county are consistent with one another and work that they together to manage growth. And countywide planning policies may include a means to allocate OFM forecasts, 20-year countywide population targets to each city for incorporation into each city's comprehensive plan. Some cities have chosen to allocate employment targets using 20-year employment projections. A mechanism for the county to designate urban growth areas. And we'll talk about urban growth areas later on as well. The CPPs can also address the needs for affordable housing, policies that address siting of public facilities of a countywide or statewide nature, such as wastewater treatment facilities, highways or prisons or airports, folded into the countywide planning policies. There's really not a mandate or formula as to what you should or shouldn't put in a countywide planning policy, because it is your county, and you have to decide what's important and what policies should be in there. Also, supported but financially realistic plans can be addressed in countywide planning policies as well. Urban growth areas. Fully planning counties must work with cities to designate existing and future urban growth areas. This is something that is really important, and it's kind of unique because a lot of other areas of the country don't use this type of methodology. They don't have urban. They have urban growth, which you might think of as urban growth areas, but they don't refer to them in this manner, and they don't kind of look at them in the same manner that Washington State does. Population projections from OFM and regional allocation for each city are sort of bounded by the urban growth area, or no, sorry, that's a pun. or you kind of are in related to urban growth area boundaries. The analysis of buildable land and available opportunities for contiguous and orderly development are sort of defined by urban growth areas. And the calculation of sufficient land for 20 years of growth based on zoning and considering a market factor is related to urban growth area boundaries. The ability of local government to provide adequate public facilities and to serve development. This is a really important thing, because if you have a urban growth area that goes beyond your fiscal, financial capacity to serve in terms of infrastructure or whatever, then you've got to, this is where it becomes really important, and you need to think about how your urban growth areas are or are not. There have been three type of land use resources, obviously urban, rural, and resource, and they fall under kind of varying types of categories. The dark green is resource lands. The light green are rural lands, and the yellow and the red are urban. And that's fairly, people who lived out here, kind of, it's fairly obvious or familiar pattern. And allocating population and designating UGAs is one of the is kind of the crux of all of this, because you don't want to have a UGA that keeps expanding every year. Otherwise, there's no point in doing this exercise. It's just kind of looking at an organized sprawl. And the idea behind having an urban growth area is to grow and function and plan within those boundaries, so you're not either going beyond your capacity to your fiscal and financial capacity to serve, and also so that you can adequately and efficiently, kind of marshal where growth is and where it isn't. Also, you want to be able to preserve rural areas and maintain rural character. There's in many counties, there's a push and pull between people who are kind of willing to encroach upon rural areas and rural character, and those people who are really interested in having more urban areas and urban types of services and facilities. But that's an issue that's very much left to the counties and cities to decide what they think should and shouldn't be occurring within their boundaries. Required elements of the comprehensive plan, and probably some of you who've been around probably know this pretty well. You've got land use, transportation, housing, utilities, capital facilities, and for counties only, you have rural elements. And those are things that are utilities. Those are things that you're required to, those are elements that you're required to have. And these aren't the only elements that you're required to have, meaning you can have, there are discretionary elements that you can add. I've heard of some counties that have chapters on food security, there are, of course, my specialty is in sustainability and climate change. So, I'll use this as a shameless plug to encourage, the addition of a sustainability chapter to a comprehensive plan, which is well within any county's right to do. And for most of these issues, you can. You do have to tailor them to what the things that are going on in your, you know, in your jurisdiction and known in your, in each of the cities and outside the cities and in the UGAs and outside the UGAs. An example, but an example of how some of these are different, the transportation element needs to inventory existing transportation networks and identify needed improvements in those that will arise with future growth. This element must adjust transit, if applicable, and include a bicycle and pedestrian component. Now, that's fairly specific, but it really does make for something that people can understand and relate to, and also it helps you kind of, when going through the process of a transportation element, it really does help you see what you need and what you don't need. And a lot of times you probably experience this, lots of people from the public, you'll tend to get a lot of comments on transportation chapters and transportation elements. The land use element shows where and at what density future growth can develop. The element must also include policies addressing quality and quantity of groundwater, stormwater runoff, and guidance for corrective actions to mitigate pollution of waters and of the state, including Puget Sound, and consider strategies for promoting physical activity. The land use element sort of in a way drives all the others, because if you don't understand kind of what, how you're going to do your zoning, how you're going to do your land use, how you want to do these things, it becomes a lot more difficult in terms of planning for transportation, housing, and capital facilities, and as well as rural character. The utilities element has become more and more important as we become more kind of connected to cell phones. Telecommunications is something that's going to be addressed. Infrastructure needed to provide electricity, natural gas, whether it is the counties providing these things or not. One of the things that needs to happen that we will kind of go into in a little more detail is kind of the consistency. So the utilities, a utilities chapter and a capital facilities chapter really should kind of, you know, bridge off of each other, and the same thing with transportation. Transportation, utilities, and capital facilities really need to be very consistent. You know, one thing should either reference the other, or one should be folded into the other, or talk about the other by reference. But those three elements of a comprehensive plan really do need to be coordinated. And that sort of bridges me into this next slide: internal consistency and external consistency. Internal consistency means that all the elements must be based on the same future land use plan map and population projection. Concurrency, which is really specifically related to more to transportation, but you do have the option of kind of coupling other things with concurrency. Concurrency means that adequate public facilities are available when the impacts of development occur without decreasing level of service below locally established minimums, and concurrency is required for transportation within 6 years from the time of development, and is optional for other services like sewer, water, utilities, parks, fire, and police. But there are some communities that couple some of those types of things to concurrency. Externally consistent means that the plan must be consistent with countywide planning policies. We talked about the CPPs. So if something is talked about in the CPPs, it should be identical in your inside your comprehensive plan. Each jurisdiction's development regulations and planning activities and capital budgets must be consistent with and if they're not, it's really hard to implement the comprehensive plan if there's grotesque inconsistencies. And even small ones can be problematic. Adopting the comprehensive plan. A lot of you probably know this that have been involved with it. Obviously, you need to have public outreach early and often. Review by the Planning Commission, which is you all. A complete State Environmental Policy Act, or SEPA review, environmental review. And 60 days notice to the state, which is the Department of Commerce, which is where we come in. So, because I'm the contact person for the peninsula area, your comprehensive plan and the cities inside the county, their comprehensive plans would eventually get to me for 60-day notice, under the 60-day notice. And this last bullet or check mark is something I wanted to kind of touch on because it's become an issue of late. It may have been an issue before I came along, but we as an agency, we don't approve your comprehensive plan. Nobody's sitting there saying, toss it or putting a stamp on it. By you recommending it to the council and the council signing off on it via an ordinance, and then it coming to us within 60 days means it's a done deal. However, part of the problem is that, you know, we don't know, may not know that it's like if some jurisdictions do their plans in pieces and parts. And so they turn in a bulk of their comprehensive plan at one stage. The development regulations come in weeks and months later. Critical areas come in later. But what would really help you and would help us as well is if in some type of resolution or as part of an ordinance of some sort, you say, we've done all these things. You know, give the date that they were adopted by your council or by a council or by the appropriate authority. And then, so when someone comes, when you apply for a grant and they come to us and say, are they in compliance with the GMA? We can just go, oh yeah, they're done. Yeah, they're in compliance. And then there's no ifs, ands, or buts about making applications for grants because we have that from you, which documents that you're finished. And this is just a brief review about the comprehensive plans. They typically are only amended once per year. A lot of jurisdictions amend it when they redo their capital budgets and capital improvement programs. Our state law says they have to be updated every 8 years. So we've got 2023 come around the corner and can be appealed within 60 days to a regional growth management hearings board. And that's what you don't want to happen, but that is the option that people have. So, and again, you want to make sure, one of the things that you want to make sure of in terms of, you know, appeals and so forth, that if things are consistent and there's been adequate public process, that decreases the probabilities of appeal to a certain extent.
Talk about valid.
Yes, valid, and your comprehensive plan. If you are challenged, if you are appealed, your plan is just like your plan is valid until there's a decision. Now, if there's a decision that it has to be remanded and you've got to go back and do things, you're out of compliance until there's been an agreement with the appellant. And you know, and things are completed, and then the hearings board says, okay, you're good to go, and then you can move to the next issue. Implementing your comprehensive plan. How do you put a comprehensive plan into motion? A lot of public people get really frustrated because if something goes into the comprehensive plan and never happens. Or if a policy is in the comprehensive plan and it never goes forward, people get upset, or people that are watching get upset. Development regulations set standards for how development occurs. So when you put development regulations in your comprehensive plan updated or not, it really sets the standards for how you're going to develop in your jurisdiction in the future. Capital improvement plans or capital improvement programs set the priorities for your infrastructure investments, transportation, parks, schools, other things that you want to push forward, or typically move forward and once a year and their capital improvement plans. And typically, these are things that are going to be put into motion over the next 6 years. And other discretionary programs. If you have a policy by which you want to implement something, it's perfectly within your purview to have it in as a regulation or as something in a policy that can push that thing forward and reflect the values that you have. Development regulations, and we just as we briefly touched on, include zoning, critical areas, public work standards, subdivision regulations, and other regulations such as design standards, parking regulations, health and safety, and again, these are things that help you implement your comprehensive plan. They help, all of these things help push things forward. Capital facilities. What can we afford? Level of service, local expectation for a facility as development occurs, and it's required for transportation facilities. It's helpful for other things, you know, setting a level of service for things like parks, you know, how many parks do you need per population, setting a level of service for issues related to fire service, you know, can be done. So level of service is a helpful tool. It does keep your feet to the fire, you know, pun intended, because if people are going to be, if you're going to provide a level of service, then it's incumbent upon the jurisdiction to monitor, are these levels of service being met? And, you know, that's relative to concurrency as well. Concurrency is a much tighter standard, because if you're not meeting concurrency, you know, it says development must be denied or levels of service must be reassessed. If you're missing levels of service, unless you've coupled such a thing to concurrency or you've coupled level of service to something that is what's called necessary to support development, or something that is necessary that you prioritized, then someone needs to stay on top of it to make sure that it is happening, or you're not going below a level of service that you're committed to. Reassessment is part of that. If someone, if you are called out on an issue of that, hey, you know, traffic is too bad here, you know, I know, and someone hires a consultant and determines that you're missing your level of service. Well, you've got the GMA gives you some options for, you know, you are required to kind of reassess. Now, you can even decide to do a number of things. You can either decide to put the money into a certain project say a roadway to increase the level of service to where it needs to be. You can raise a surrender flag and say, we can't do it, and lower the level of service, which might make you unpopular with your constituents and the public. Or you can do something, or if this were eight years from now, you could do a reassessment of land use. We are going to shift the zoning. We are going to shift our land use so that we can provide a certain level of service of whatever it is in that area. Meaning, say, people are complaining that there aren't enough parks. Well, if land use and zoning are making it hard to get to acquire park property, you know, you'd make some adjustments so that you can meet whatever level of service commitment you had toward providing parks. Other programs that can implement comprehensive plan goals, interlocal agreements. You know, if you want, if you need to make an agreement with a city or jurisdiction, you know, to try to work on providing certain services, incentives such as tax exemptions, open space or multifamily housing to provide for multifamily or housing or open space are things that you can do. Streamline development process for specific types of development. That makes you really, really popular. If you can tell people that you'll be able to have some type of status with a permit application in a certain time, and people can have some predictability, you know, the better off you're going to be. Impact fees. Impact fees are a interesting component of Growth Management Act and of comprehensive plans. Impact fees can help pay for added impacts to the growth to transportation, parks, or school systems, or fire infrastructure. They can only be charged for facilities identified in the plan. So what that's saying is that if you don't identify a certain types of things in your comprehensive plan, you can't say, if you didn't identify, something that you could put in there, it's optional that you might put in your comprehensive plan. If you don't have that thing identified in your comprehensive plan, you cannot charge impact fees for it, because there has to be a nexus between one, where it is let me use the example of parks. There has to be a nexus between where you're charging impact fees, what the impact is, and what the impact fees are being used for. You can't, if parks were not in your comprehensive plan, you couldn't charge impact fees for them. I'm trying to think of another example of something that you, well, I guess fire service was one of the something. Every jurisdiction doesn't have fire service related to in its comprehensive plan or addressed in its comprehensive plan. But you can. You can put fire service inside a comprehensive plan and talk about kind of how it is or isn't going to, how much fire service infrastructure you are or are not going to have. And you can also add levels of service to it. However, if you don't address fire service in a comprehensive plan, you can't charge impact fees for it. And that's a relatively new development because for a while there wasn't the ability to charge impact fees for fire service infrastructure at all. Transfer of development rights. Do you all know or are familiar with transfer of development rights? It means that a program can be used to buy the potential for developing land from sensitive environmental areas or important resource lands and transfer the development potential into an urban area. So you're swapping with someone in order to say to preserve farmland or some other type of thing that's people want to maintain. Volunteer programs can help accomplish goals that a city or county may not be able to pay for, such as habitat restoration activities or recreations, and that's, you know, that can typically come through a parks element of a comprehensive plan. Updating and completing your comprehensive plans. We didn't put that's blank because these dates down here reflect kind of when the comprehensive plans from various jurisdictions were due. The Snohomish King and Pierce County comprehensive plans were due in 2015. Your comprehensive plans are due this year by the end of June 30th. We're rather in the purple shaded counties. 2017 are the kind of brownish gold shaded counties, and 2018 are the blue shaded counties in which they do. And this is also the type of thing where, you know, we understand that people are strapped, various jurisdictions are strapped for resources and staff and things of this nature. So, you know, you can apply for extensions. You know, depends on when it is. And
we can.
But
there is a 12-month grace period,
yes,
for the critical areas ordinance that you won't be ineligible for these grants. If you've done everything else except the critical areas ordinance, you're still eligible. Nobody can approve extensions, so it's in the statute.
For grant loans requiring updated, yes, upon completion, yes. But you don't, the long and short of it is start early so you can get these things in on time. Yes.
So it's my understanding that there was something being brought forward by Sherry Appleton to have Kitsap County plan the next cycle a full year early.
Yes.
Why do you have to change the law to do it early? That doesn't make any sense. So what's the benefit to that?
Well, to change the law to move earlier is because these are kind of set up in the Growth Management Act. So to do it, you'd have to kind of tweak the laws to move earlier. But the benefit to moving earlier on paper is because you would be you'd be working with Vision 2040 from the Puget Sound Regional Council.
Yeah, is that what you were going to
say? Yeah, Puget Sound Regional Council. We want to get the money with the rest.
I was going to say, it has to be connected to some kind of money, because why would you do it? I mean,
it's
painful as it is. I mean, it's like, you know.
Yeah, it is connected to Vision 2040 and Puget Sound Regional Council and the funds that you would be eligible from planning under Vision 2040. So, of course, it does put stress on the staff. It puts stress on you, you know. But, you know, it's the type of thing where, you know, the benefits may outweigh the relative stress that you might temporarily go under. You know.
So the grant programs that you have identified, mm-hmm, there, those are actual awards of funds from those. So you could be out of compliance potentially in terms of not having your critical area ordinance done by June 30th, you would be ineligible to actually execute an action for funding. But can you still apply for those if you are not compliant?
You have to be in compliance at the time of award. They were kind of all over the place, so a couple years we synced it up so that for every one of these, you can apply if you're out of compliance, but you can't get the money until you're in compliance, which is a pretty good motivation to get the work done.
Sure. Yeah, the grants that, if you're not in compliance, well, kind of the way the process works is a lot of times some of these people will call us to see if a certain jurisdiction is in compliance. And if they're not, then, you know, then you'd be contacted. So, you would need to be in compliance, you know, at a certain time in order to receive an award. What the GMA requires. The review of the bullets that are up there, you at the very least need to review them and take a look at them. The staff needs to review them and take a look at them. Some things may or may not need to be updated if they're not they don't need to be updated, I mean, that's one thing. Revise, if they do need to be updated, you would obviously revise if necessary. And then sometimes you may need to take, you know, legislative action to complete it. And it's the type of thing that it will vary from jurisdiction, from year to year. And some things, you know, you may need to completely revise. Other things, you know, you may need to leave alone. One of the things that is something that people really kind of need to pay attention to is when you're doing goals and objectives and policies inside of a comprehensive plan. You know, there are sometimes, and this is just to reduce a vulnerability of a challenge. You know, are we really going to, you know, do this? I mean, it's no crime if it's like, hey, well, we can't do something. You know, just, you know, obviously strike it out and say, well, we're not doing this, or we don't have the money to do this. Or, you know, we don't have the resources to do it, but it's really important to review goals, objectives, and policies just to make sure that, you know, you are or are not doing kind of what you want to do. How effective planning can make your jurisdiction's visions real, and there's quite a few success stories. And really, some of these are some of these are really good success stories. On the bullet list, Everett Painfield, the downtown Vancouver, Tacoma downtown, downtown Burien. You know, you can take a look at kind of how the outcome of some of these areas, it's kind of a result of sub-area plans that are part of comprehensive plans, and, you know, you take a look at them, and it's like, you know, they put it together, and they put it in a plan, and then they made it happen, and then people were happy with it, and that's kind of the really good success story that you can that you can look at. And, you know, you can really kind of, if you travel a bit, you can, after a while, you can kind of look at kind of a place that's well planned and go, oh. And you can find places that were poorly planned and go, oh, you know, this, you know.
Do you know what the planned action is? Can we talk a little bit about that? Planned action means that you've done a sub-area plan and then you do the CEQA work. So that any development that comes in that area that meets the specifications, the CEQA has already been done. So it's a lot less risk to a developer, so that when they come in, the project to move ahead more smoothly. So it can be a great incentive to get development that's as you plan.
Because then the developer does not have to pony up the cost of a CEPA evaluation if it's been done up front.
Or the risk of an appeal.
The risk of appeal as well, yes. And this is a...
Do you want me to give you...
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and look at Anne and do these, because she's had a lot of experience with successful ventures.
Well, I've been doing the short course for many years, and it's just great to have stories of planning done well and things happen, especially with very few resources. So this is the town of Grandview. They did a downtown plan, and they really wanted to beautify it. And they got a small grant to do downtown improvements. And there was a local woman who loved to garden, and they put the beds in, and she said, I will take over them, because I will look after them. This is what I want to do for my community. So all of a sudden, the downtown looks beautiful, and the property owners are like, well, my building looks kind of bad against this beautiful streetscape. So that public investment leveraged private investment, and the downtown streetscape, as a result of small improvements, all of a sudden became a lot more attractive. And the same thing happened in the neighborhoods. They did some planning on where they wanted improvements to sidewalks, and they got some small funding to put those in place, and the property owners were like, oh, maybe I better clean up my place. So with a good plan and a little bit of investment, the whole town really became much more attractive and proud of their community. This is in the town of Hoquiam. They did a process to think about what really was the biggest issues. I mean, it's a community with a lot of needs. They had another program where somebody got together with a bunch of paint and painted all the houses that looked the worst. But in this one, they said we really need new sidewalks. And instead of having because the sidewalks are the responsibility of the property owner, instead of having them hire a contractor separately, they said, if you need a new sidewalk, we'll put you on this list and we'll hire the contractor and you provide us some of the funding and we'll go out and we'll get them all done at once. So the price was less than half to the property owners and they got a whole bunch of sidewalks done. This is a personal example. I was on the Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee in the City of Olympia for 6 years. And we were updating our comprehensive plan, and we had a network of bike lanes really on arterials. And the goal was more people biking more often. And if you're not a super cyclist, an arterial is a pretty scary place to cycle. We said, well, really, we want a place where families can cycle, and there was no network in the downtown. Let's explore a bicycle corridor, low traffic routes where people can ride. So we put it on our work plan, and then we looked at potential routes through town. That's the purple. And then we worked with council and said, well, it's not that much money. We need signs and paint. And can you provide us some funds? They put $100,000 towards the project. I rotated off the committee. And about a year later, I'm walking home and, hey, they're putting the stencils down. So 7 years later, this idea that we put in the comp plan started to appear. So this is your last slide.
This is the last slide, and it gives you kind of a schematic about successful planning. You have a community vision or goal. You put that goal in a comprehensive plan, implementation strategies, and then you make it happen with the way you do your permitting, the way you do your zoning maps. And your spending decisions, and how you're going to do your budgets and financial, and the bullets are very self-explanatory. Regulations that are clear and flexible reflect the goals of the plan. Incentives encourage the type of development that you want. A clear process for reviewing development proposals against the plan and regulations is really, really helpful. When especially for people who are developers, and leadership is involved at all levels, and that includes you, the council, the staff, the management, staff management, all of you more or less need to be on the same page to come to an agreement on the goals and policies, and then you can be very effective in moving things forward and having the type of community that you want to have in the future. And if you got any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
Just real quick, I don't know if it's you who answers or Scott or someone else. So as I understand, Kitsap County, our 2016 cycle is through. We're valid with no appeals except CAO. We still have to update the CAO. Is that? Is that where we're at?
We have appeals.
We do have appeals.
We do have some pending appeals right now that are in process. And we have the critical area ordinance.
Okay, so we have appeals before the growth management hearing board right now.
Right.
And as Ann inferred, you're still valid until the outcome of the appeal, and you do have till 2017 to finish the critical areas and areas ordinance regulation. And since you've had this, please put a resolution or a whereas or a finding when this is all said and done, just kind of checking off when all the things were said and done. And so that in a database, when you're looking for a grant and someone asks, is Kitsap County in compliance? Yes, they are.
That's the question, Gary. When someone asks, you're going to say yes.
Well, that's the, I prefer to say yes, because if, you know, saying no and why, it's like, oh, man, but what's worse is this, like, I don't know, because then having to rifle, you know, because it's like, well, we got, well, yeah, I have to get on the phone, and it's like, well, the plan came in then, did they send development regulations? I don't know. It's like, you know, whereas if at the end of your ordinance, or if there's a resolution that comes in with the plan, and it's got just sort of a, however you phrase it, say, you know, the comp plan was completed day X. We resolved the challenge with the growth board date X, and then the other the car was finished on a certain date, and development regs. Like, okay, there it is. We're done. The reason why I put that forward is because lots of people aren't doing it. And, you know, when someone calls me up and says, oh, are they in compliance, and I don't know, like, it takes a lot of, you know, time and trouble to try to track things down and make sure that they are.
Okay. Any more questions for Gary? Y'all good? Do you want a little minute just to stretch?
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Okay, we'll reset for 5 minutes. Okay.